Hey, what's your problem? You have business problems? We have business solutions.
Not guaranteed.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
Life is a fight.
It is.
In business, every day is a fight.
It can be.
So, hey, what's your problem?
Yes, thank you, John David Wells.
Love that guy. Big voice guy for the program here on the What's Your Problem podcast. This is a podcast for business owners and professionals all around the Middle Tennessee area that contend with the notion of it's always something. Something's always kind of keeping you up, nudging you. What's next? You know, generally our lives are pretty good. But, you know, there's only that one thing. You always like sleeping with one eye semi-open at night. This is a video and audio podcast. Check us out at whatsyourproblempodcast.com. It is there where you can pick your poison, where you can find the most ideal place to listen to us or even watch us. If you want to watch, see my ugly mug do this on video,
it's not ugly.
You know, I appreciate that. Self-deprecating humor, you got to do it every now and then. I am your host, Jim McCarthy with Jim McCarthy Voiceovers. And that voice you hear is our guest today, Mr. Brother, Paul Brown. How you doing, sir?
Man, I'm great.
I mean, what an amazing experience and time we're going to have today. Brother Paul Brown is an American musician and Grammy-nominated keyboardist, producer, and composer, most associated for his work as a record producer and keyboardist, organist, with the Waterboys, among others, a whole host of other bands.
Yep.
You've worked with a lot of people. But first, of course, we're going to do something that we call... Get it going. Here we go. We like to get the juices flowing, the creative energy. And as I'm, like, you know, juggling here, because my life is one big juggle. That's my problem, Paul. Is that I'm constantly juggling and spinning plates.
Man, it looks like a good juggle, though, to me.
You know, I've tried to get away from it. It never works out when you try and focus on one thing. I got to do a million different things. All right, so the...
You ought to see me on a sit and spin. For hours, man.
There you go, man. So we do something called the Random Five, brought to you by itsyourshow.co. That is essentially my company, where if you want a podcast like this, that's what we can do for you. Make it a video podcast, make sure it's syndicated out to all the right carriers and all that fun stuff, and make you look and sound as best as you possibly can. Itsyourshow.co. All right, Brother Paul, here we go, because we're getting deep into this thing. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Five random questions. And this is a funny question. Okay. Number one, what would an exact opposite of you be like? Completely energyless.
Just completely energyless. It'd have all the fingers.
Have all the fingers. We'll get into that story too.
It'd have a Diet Coke instead of tea.
Okay. Random question completely. Here we go.
I love them.
What's your best podcast recommendation, aside from this one, of course?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Are you a big podcast guy?
I'm not. I'm really not.
What do you listen to? What do you like to listen to?
Spotify.
Spotify music?
Yeah.
A lot of music?
Yeah.
Any particular...
CNN.
Really, CNN?
Yeah.
You marinate your mind in the politics and the news, huh?
Yeah. And then I hose it off you know, Spotify Spanish playlist. I don't understand any of the lyrics.
Nice. Okay, number three, what happens more often than you'd like?
Wait.
Wait? Actual physical weight?
Actual physical weight, man.
I can agree with that one. Not on you, but on me.
It's feast or famine with me.
Really?
Man.
Is it a tough thing?
Yeah. Well, because when I get in these these work cycles, man, and it's like this video, especially in video world, man. Yeah. I can go for like
you got to stay in shape, right?
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Planet Fitness.
I mean, I can hide all my fat beneath my desk here, and it's a top-down camera shot, you know, for a reason. Makes really? It look. It's a good angle for me, right?
Man, well, I've got a lot tucked in.
Oh, I don't believe it. What are we on? Question four? I can never count these things.
I thought it was three. Opposite? Oh, no. That was three we just did. Yeah, four.
Yeah. So, this is question four. What was something you loved, but it never really took off or was ended before its time?
my finger.
That's a great answer. We'll just go with that. We'll make it quick. Question number five. That's hilarious. Who would you want to play you in a movie about your life?
Oh, man. Sammy Hagar?
Yeah. He could be. I'm pretty sure he could act.
Yeah.
He could totally pull it off. I mean, I don't know if he's been in a keyboard player and make it look
convincing. He could work. He could work it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go. There's the random five brought to you by itsyourshow.co. And we're going to get into it, starting with the finger story. I mean, you're a keyboardist. You know, you're one of these guys that's just made an impressive career out of what you do. But you've got 9 digits instead of 10.
Well, I got 9 3/4.
9 3/4.
And part of the
feeling. Isn't that like the Harry Potter thing?
Yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah.
Kind of creepy, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it still works out. It feels like it's about half asleep. But I can't play guitar. You know, as a matter of fact, on the fourth question, I could have just said either my finger or guitar.
So you were a guitarist at one point,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I could live under a guitar cabinet.
Really?
Gosh, oh, man, I love my guitar junkie.
No kidding.
Yeah, man.
And you can't play it whatsoever?
Well, it just feels weird because it's my left hand, so it'd be my chord hand.
Right.
So as long as I don't use that, you know, that finger, that it's next to the pinky. What would that be called?
The ring finger.
Ring finger, yeah. And it feels so weird that I just don't have any, I just rather watch somebody great play.
Oh, really? That's nuts. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you started out, you know, I was reading that it was kind of a long process to, you know, I guess with anything, if you're going to do something in the creative arts, music, acting, anything like that, it's going to take a while for it to really start to feel like you're getting some traction. So, I mean, in the early 90s, it looked like you started to, all right, I'm here. I know what to kind of get going. Tell me the story.
90 was a big deal for me. Yeah, it sure was. Because I was bound and determined to be a rock singer.
Yeah.
And I don't have a rock singer voice, man.
You got some voice. I mean,
well, I do. Yeah. No, I can sing background for days. But, mm-hmm. I was trying my best, man. And I had a band called Big Life. It was And we were cutting stuff, and then I actually had all my keyboards off stage, and I had this cat running little sequences and stuff, you know, but I didn't gravitate, you know. So, thankfully, keyboards really just saved my butt, man.
Were you always adept at playing them? Was it something you did since a kid?
Yeah. Really? It was always a part of me. In a school for the homeless, that's where I started. At that time, it really pulled me through. It saved my life in a lot of ways. So I ended up getting a soul gig, man, and with Shirley Brown from Stax.
Right.
And all of a sudden, my whole musical life changed, and that was at the moment I got introduced to the Hammond B3 organ, and all of a sudden, everything just, you know, everything started changing, and I found that I was able to keep rock incorporated in everything that I was doing anyway.
The B3 lays such a foundation for, you know, the right songs. I played with a B3 up in Michigan. My brother had me fly up to play a church service with him where we played Angry Young Man by Billy Joel.
Yeah.
My brother's a keyboardist as well. He's been playing since he's 6. Mm-hmm. So we went up, we performed it. You can find it on YouTube. And one of the guys has got the Hammond B3. And oh my gosh, what an experience.
Yeah.
It's such a cool sound.
It just became an extension of my soul.
Yeah.
And still is. And the thing I love about, because this is all in Memphis, you know, all the basic roots of my playing, the soul of my playing all come from Memphis.
Right.
And I moved to Nashville in 2006 to play with a blues guy, Stacy Mitchhart.
Right.
Great guy. I love him. And so I found myself being able to bring all the soul from Memphis to Nashville. So yeah. Now when I do just tons of sessions on Hammond B3, but in this, you know, the band, the Waterboys, the same thing, you know, they're based out of Ireland and Scotland and London. Mm-hmm. And, but I get to bring all this Memphis soul on Hammond B3 to this group.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's so distinctly different. The Memphis sound, the Nashville sound. Now even, you know, we watched a documentary a couple of, 2 months ago on Muscle Shoals. Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea. Completely. And even my brother, who's, you know, we're both been in music since, gosh, I mean, I've been a drummer since I was 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
He's played since he's six. And I said, have you ever realized how much music, how many hits came out of Muscle Shoals, Alabama?
Yeah.
He had no idea. And we consider ourselves to be pretty knowledgeable.
Yeah.
I mean, I came up in freaking music radio, for crying out loud. Yeah. I should know these things.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you, man. I didn't have that much of a clue either.
Right.
And then the first Waterboys album that I recorded with them, David Hood from the Swampers was on bass.
Right, right.
And then he ended up doing the whole tour. David hadn't toured since Traffic in 1972.
Right.
And he toured with us for 2 years.
You want to hear ignorance? I had no idea that the Swampers were being referenced in Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh, wow.
None. You know that, you know, they're referenced.
Yeah, yeah, right.
No idea. Muscle Shoals has got the Swampers.
Right, right.
Ooh, ooh, yeah. Ooh, you know?
Yeah. Well,
okay, that makes sense.
To be fair, for the longest time, I thought they were talking about background singers.
I thought they were talking about just, you know, maybe there were loggers or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just part of the community.
Or fish catchers in
no
a swamp.
Idea.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
I've never felt more stupid in my life.
I didn't either until 2013 when I met David. And then I found out what a swamper was.
I mean, you're basically, the Swampers are the equivalent of the Wrecking Crew.
Yes.
That was in the 60s and 70s
in
L.A. that recorded
the high rhythm section in Memphis.
There you go.
All Al Green, all that. Yeah.
Or the Three Kings here in Nashville, which is Redmond and Tully Kennedy and Kurt from the Al Dean Band.
Oh, my God, man. Don't get me started.
They were going to try to get that going for themselves.
Were they?
Years ago, yeah.
Man, they're my heroes on so many levels.
Well, I mean, when did you realize, okay, what I'm doing is starting to work, you know? What was the gig that made you kind of, I mean, was there something like that made you just kind of go, yeah, I picked the right thing?
Yeah, it was actually three soul artists into my career.
Mm-hmm.
First was Shirley Brown. The second was Jay Black. No, actually it wasn't. It was Jay Blackfoot, Shirley Brown,
mm-hmm.
and then Ann Peebles,
right.
who wrote the classic I Can't Stand the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got with her and we started writing together and then we were touring together and we were doing all these amazing festivals all over the world, that's I'm really on the right track. This is really working.
And this is in the 90s, you said, right around mm-hmm. that time?
Sure was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you've been hammering at it for 15 years.
It was 92, yeah. And then when Shirley and Jay were 90 and 91, and then before that, I was in the Barcaze, man, for a minute. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I had all this whole funk thing going on. There's two bands in Memphis, Xavion and the Barcaze, man. And they were like this rock funk and then pure funk.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was more synthetic stuff. And that was, I would say, 89.
Right.
And, but when I, still, there was a lot of fluctuation. So when I got with Ann, it's like, it felt so solid and so long term, man. It's like, I knew.
Yeah. I'm on the right track.
Yeah.
But I mean, just the fortitude, the mental, fortitude. I mean, that's the word to persist through those years. I mean, I tell any business owner, some people, I kind of equate this when I was in the car business, right? 6 months in, it felt like a lifetime. And you're wondering, did I make the right decision here?
Yeah.
I have no idea. There's so many business owners in general out there that get into year five. And I always tell people, you got to give it 5 years. You know, you're going to eat crap. You're going to eat dirt for 5 years. Guaranteed. I said, good for you if you can shorten that time amount, but count on 5 years. Yeah. Here you are. You're starting a business. It's Brother Paul Brown, Inc. 15 years in. I mean, you're kind of, I mean, those first couple of years, those, the first, you know, half decades that you were doing this,
I lived in every park in Memphis,
right,
Jim. Oh, man. Every park in Memphis at one time or the other. I worked on the river.
Right.
And I was in one of the biggest tugboat wrecks in tugboat history.
Really?
Yeah, no kidding, on the Mississippi River.
Why is that not in your wiki? Is it? That should be.
Yeah, well, it's kind of an undercurrent, right. You know, and it only comes out when I tell the story.
It's so amazing to hear. I had no idea.
Yeah, man. I could have become a captain. I mean, there was a time just before I left that I was the captains would pull me up because I was what's called a deckhand or a mate.
Yeah,
and we were loading crude oil barges now up and down the Mississippi River, and I was there for about two and a half, 3 years, and by the time that I left, the captains were having me come up and steer the boat through Baton Rouge, Louisiana, yeah. Mm-hmm. While they went down and went and hung out, you know, mm-hmm. and I still remember having Donald Fagen's, you know, just blasting the Nightfly,
yeah,
you know, on the sound system and just in the middle of the night, just, you know, steering the boats.
And that's got to be a spiritual experience. My yeah. goodness. I mean, you're on a legendary river, Old Man Riv.
Mm-hmm.
I have some friends down in Baton Rouge that I always kind of joke around. And they're locals. And I go, so is that, you call that Big Riv? The Old Man Riv? And they're like, no, it's just the Mississippi. I'm like, if I lived down here, I'd call it Big Riv.
I always said, man, if I don't ever do music again, I'd like to go back on the river. Because it's really true. They say once it's in your blood, man, it's there. And I can't, when I see a tugboat or I see go pass by a river, I always feel that
nostalgia.
Yeah, and that love for mm-hmm. it. The love for that life, for the serenity. It's just something about that, man. It's yeah. so amazing. But towards the end of my run, we were going through St. Louis and we actually hit a bridge and caught the first three boats on fire.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And thankfully they were full, so it didn't, if they would have been empty, they would have just exploded right. and then we would have all been toast. Right. But thankfully they just caught on fire. And the only one that didn't was the one on the boat, mm-hmm. the one closest to the boat. So they had broken off. And well, we had gotten them off with our, you know, just got the winch wires off, and so we're floating down with this one barge that has a hole in it.
Oh my gosh!
So now all of a sudden the boat is topping into all these and it's bogging down because there's so much smoke. There's no oxygen.
Yeah.
So anyway, we barely made it out, mm-hmm. and after that, I asked for a leave of absence, and they wouldn't give me one, so I quit. And then 3 months later, that same boat. Ran, you know what a lock is, where yeah. they raise and lower the river
yeah.
level so you can pass through.
Yeah.
The boat hit a lock and killed three deckhands and the cook. And that was the boat that I would have been on.
Oh, my gosh. So basically, I mean, if it hits a lock, is it just kind of hitting it dead on? And
it did.
The sudden stop is what can be dead.
Right, right. And then it just, when it hit, blew a hole in it in the bar, and then it just sunk.
I mean, you're on a river. I mean, you can legitimately, I guess, if you needed to, jump in the river and swim to shore. I mean, it's not too far away.
Well,
right?
the problem is the currents are so crazy
right,
on the Mississippi.
Right.
It's just brutal, man.
Yeah.
And it undertows and all that can just suck you right under. And, you know, I mean, you have your life vest.
Yeah.
And then also depends on the weather, too, you know.
Yeah.
Because in the winter, man, the waters are so freezing.
There is so many, I mean, and there's something about that river. I've lived next to the Hudson River most of my life or mm-hmm. near it. That's a huge river, but it's nothing like the length of the Mississippi, right? And then to be next to the Mississippi, during one trip to Baton Rouge with my son, uh-huh. I'm like, hey, you know, we got all our work done. Let's go to stand next to this thing, you know, because it's one of the most iconic American, just so much history there,
yeah.
You know? And we just, you know, watched some boats go by, had an experience, and it's like the amount of this history flowing down this river. So yeah. You used to get in the Baton Rouge area and have to take it out through New Orleans.
I went
and
all
stuff?
The way down to the, yeah.
That's
down,
a lot of curves, man.
All the way down, man. Yeah.
That's the curviest part of the river,
to
right?
Down to Mobile. I mean, yeah. We went all the way down just before it turns into the ocean.
Really?
Yeah, we would go all the way.
Does
yeah.
It go out to Mobile?
Yeah.
I thought it like basically just kind of brings you out to the Gulf out of Louisiana area. No,
we went to Mobile, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I would love to take a cruise up and down that river.
You should, man. Yeah. And then, you know, they have those Mississippi boat, like the paddle wheels that
yeah.
kind of look like paddle wheels, but they're actually cruise ships.
Yeah.
Should do that, man.
Yeah, you see the cruise ships, you can get them in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Like and you get on a cruise ship and it takes you right out.
That's right.
So I'm in Port of New Orleans, I guess.
Yeah, but just to go down to take a get on one of the looks like an old steamer and do the cruise down to Mississippi.
Yeah.
So
where does that begin though? Up north?
I think in Memphis.
Really?
I think you can catch one in Memphis and then just go down towards. You have to Google this because I'm not 100% sure what's changed, especially since COVID. And but yeah, well, you could catch one in Memphis and go all the way down to Louisiana.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're going to Gulf Shores next week. And my wife brought up, she goes, you know, New Orleans is only about 3 hours away. I'm going, I've been through New Orleans. For some reason, I'm fascinated with that whole part of the country.
Yeah.
You know, a city that's below sea level. You know, you can stand on the streets and look up at the ships passing you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? With the bank of the Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
That there's, you know, so many just millions, billions of gallons of water that are above you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh.
If you're 3 hours away, Jim, do it.
Yeah.
I mean, man, 3 hours away, man. Call it a day.
Go to Cafe Du Monde in the French Quarter.
Yeah, please, man. Do that, man. Yeah. I'll be looking for a report.
We'll put some pictures up on Facebook. So, I mean, here you are. You're traveling. I had no idea that, you know, that's an amazing story of you just traveling the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Having that spiritual experience, it feeds into your musicality. Did you have any instrumentation on the boats with you?
That's funny you should ask. When I got on that boat, man, I had one harmonica.
Really?
I was that broke. I had been living in parks. My older brother, Pete, was the one that actually got me on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
What I had to do, though, is I had to call every 2 weeks, man. And I did this for about a year until I was so pestering.
Right.
That
and persistence.
Persistent. But he said, you know, that's what you have to do. He said, the only way you're going to get on, you got to show them, man, that and you got to call every week or every 2 weeks. And I did. And finally I did. And when I got on the boat, I had one harmonica. By the time I left there, it took me 3 trips to get on and off that boat, man, with all the musical equipment I had acquired.
Oh, so you built up your arsenal.
Oh my God.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a 1973 Flying V, man. It was amazing. And keyboards and amps. And it took me 3 trips, man, to get back and forth to actually get my stuff on the boat.
I find that fascinating.
But it was so much fun because everybody was in on it. You know, like a lot of times, man, the deckhands would be, they played or whatever. You know, we'd have these jam sessions. It was
nice.
So much fun.
So you're on a boat, you could set up, and the people on the shores can hear you going.
That's
by.
Right.
That's awesome. What an amazing experience.
Yeah. And in the wheelhouse, you know, of course they had those mics that go through the big megaphone thing at the top, you know, and so in the middle of the night I'd be playing harmonica and you could hear it through the bullhorn at the top, and it sounded so cool, man.
Yeah.
It sounded like an Aerosmith record.
Really? An Aerosmith record, that's great. So I mean, you're going down the river, you're doing all this thing, you're adding to your musicality. Was this in your mind the plan B, and plan A was still to be doing what you're doing now? Or
yeah, plan A was always to find a way to do what I was doing.
Right.
To do what I do now. And then when I left, man, it plummeted all over again, man.
Really?
I went through I did so many things. I, you know, worked at all night Exxon gas stations. I worked Mr. Pride car wash.
Right. You
know, like mm-hmm. I did everything. But then I landed a job. There was one at the car wash that I worked. I think the car wash was the last regular gig that I had.
Mm-hmm.
But right around the corner from the car wash, they had a music store. And what I would do is after I'd get off the meet, I'd just go in the music store for as long as they would let me play and just noodle and play, you know, and they had a keyboard room and the owners were noticing so many kids were watching me and their parents were coming. So they offered me a gig teaching.
Nice.
And I've never taught. I mean, I had so like near zero theory.
Yeah.
You know,
I'll just teach you what I know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Just, and so so what I did is, and it really, in a huge way, it made such an impact on my ranging and scoring and writing, because while I was teaching all these little kids all my these techniques that I just, you know, made up on my own, I was reading all these books on theory, and so I was able to start writing notes and teaching them that, you know, along the way. So I was learning while I was teaching them.
Yeah.
And it was huge, man. And
there is a phenomenon to that, where every time you get into a teaching role, you yourself are often your biggest student.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Same thing with voiceover. When I'm teaching my clients, you know, we're doing voiceover coaching, things of that nature. I'll start talking about stuff because I believe that creativity begets creativity. So once you start flowing with the conversation, you never know what an idea will just pop in your head, because all of a sudden you're open to receive.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens all the time. All of a sudden I'll spew out some sort of an idea with a student. I'm like, that's a really good idea. I should do that. You know,
yeah.
Like
I can't tell you how many times that happened to me.
Right.
Like, I'm using this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so beautiful. I was like feeding them and feeding myself at the same time. And it was great. And at the end of it, it went such a long way to me becoming, when I ended up with Ann Peebles and became her musical director, all of a sudden I was writing all these horn charts for all these music. So along the way, it just instilled so much theory that really made it so much of an easier hill to climb when I got into the world of arranging and doing charts.
Right.
Especially right. Musical charts. This is not Nashville's number system, but this is like note
orchestration.
Charts. Real orchestration.
Yeah, actual notation.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, a lot of people like myself, I'm a drummer. Not to the extent of being able to read like our friend Mr. Rich Redman, but I mean I can't do any of that stuff. I've just never could listen to a song and be able to play it back pretty much rote, you know, verbatim, if you will.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, maybe not the bass drum pattern shift up here and I do my own thing, but I mean, Rich would tell me, he says, yeah, I actually got, if we had to cover a song, I would actually mimic and copy the bass drum pattern of the original drummer. And I'm going, yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I'm just, I you know, we're going to milk it to a certain extent, you know?
Well, you know what? I can't sit down and play. You can't put a sheet of music in front of me and yeah. I can play it. I can read it and know what it is, but I can't read it fast enough to where I could just play.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I can write it for days and I
really?
Know. Yeah.
So if you see a piece of music, you can hear it in your head.
Yes.
While you're, wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you're doing it for multi-instruments.
Yeah.
Horn sections, strings.
Really? Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely.
All from just teaching kids.
Yeah. Well, not all from treating.
Or starting. That was
starting. It was the starting point. Yeah. There was a point where we were going to do a tour with Ann. Didn't happen.
Right.
We were going to do this tour with Ann with a live string section.
Mm.
So we had six horns and we were going to do like eight-piece string section. And so, I really didn't know any. I didn't know that much about. I didn't know where string relations were in terms of charts.
Yeah.
And I had some horn. I could write horn charts, but I had really no clue about strings. So one of my dear friends, James Mitchell, who was Willie Mitchell's brother, Willie Mitchell, of course, was the producer for High Records that produced all the Al Green and Ann Peeble stuff. Well, his brother was a baritone sax player, but he was also the guy who wrote all those amazing string parts for those beautiful Al Green records. And well, I was living downtown in Memphis, and he was working at an all-night guards mar. He was a guard, security guard for a building that was just down the street from my apartment. So what I did, every night after I would go play on Beale Street, and after my gig, I would go hang out with him, and I'd take all these score sheets and pencils and he would show me how he wrote those parts and why he wrote weight a lot different from normal writers. Like, he would voice the cellos in a weird place that you would normally, you know, place them in relation to the other strings, but it's what made the Al Green's records and would made all those High records sound so unique in terms of their string arrangement. So that was how I was going to prep myself to write these string parts that I was hearing in my head for this tour. And I did that for about a year. And also what I did is I had Manny. Remember how you, when you were just a tiny kid, how you learned your ABCs and you would write A's forever and yeah. B's. And
well, I should have spent more time on that, but yes.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. I can't. Yeah. I can't draw stick men. Yeah. But what I did is I did, you know, notes, eighth notes, whole notes, staffs, flags, rest. There are miles of score sheets with nothing but little notes. I still have them.
Yeah.
And all they, well, not all of them, but they have all these, it's just notes and staff. And all of a sudden, before I knew it, I was just writing really legible notation.
Yeah.
And so by the time that we were really ready to put the tour together, I had the whole show scored out for six strings, six horns, and eight strings. It was, and then the tour fell apart because the budget didn't work.
But at least you got that experience under your belt.
Man, it carried me so long. It carried me so far. But even now, like when I arrange stuff and when I write string parts or when I do string, I'm always going back to those nights with hanging out with James Mitchell. It's amazing.
It's amazing to me because, like, as I do these podcast episodes, I kind of formulate what the headline is going to look like and the summary of what the episode is about. And for me, it's like you never know why a certain situation didn't work out until you get 25,000 feet away from it.
That's
the 25,000 foot view, right?
Yeah.
At the time you're at, 500 feet off the ground, you're looking at it with, your hand on your face kind of thing. But until you put some time behind you, all of a sudden, that must have been devastating to hear that the tour fell apart, right?
Yeah.
You were counting on it. You put so much work and blood, sweat, and tears into it. But all of a sudden, you've got this wealth of experience. Now I can do this for another show.
Yeah. And, you know, Jim, I was always what has got me so far is I had this ability to always take a terrible situation and look at the bright side.
Beautiful.
Always, man. As soon as the tour didn't happen, man, I just said to myself, think about what you've got. Think about the not. Look at all these score sheets and know that you'll be able to use them someday for something.
Did you have that always when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I had it. I didn't have it. I had it in the homeless school.
Right. Just looking at finding the one positive thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It really, yeah. And there were so many devastating times, man, within the homeless school that I was in, which was actually here in Nashville.
Right.
And so I wet the bed. That was the first thing I had going against me. And, and so there were.
This wasn't last week or anything, was it?
No, man. Let me check.
Sorry, I had to.
Man, no, it's all good. No, that stopped as weird as it started. I mean, like, it just one day it just stopped. There was no, I tried taking pills for it. You know, they get all these remedies. They try, you know, throwing one at one point in the homeless school, they threw my mattress out of the window in the, of the second story in front of all the students that were walking by our dorm to go to school.
And how old were you at that time?
Probably 13, 14.
Okay, yeah, very impressionable.
Yeah. So, but at that, but any, I could, it was during that time that I developed this innate ability to take any bad situation like that. Like when she threw my mattress out, I was like, well, I get to go to the auditorium and practice later. So right. I'm going to do that. And I've got a band, you know, and through every setback in my life, I've always been, you know, been able to do that.
And just find the gold.
Just find the gold, man.
And it's, that's, I guess there's the answer to your perseverance.
Yeah.
Because you got to have some sort of, you know, one thing to hope on, and you find it and you hope on it.
Yeah.
You know, I have those kinds of conversations with my kids.
Really?
My son, a couple of weeks ago, it was first day of school, and we drove by. He was going to the high school for the first time, being in ninth grade. And we drove past the middle school where he spent the last 3 years of his life. And it was not a good experience for him. I mean, middle school is tough for anybody, as you well know.
Oh, right? Yeah, man.
So we're driving past and he's like, I'm so glad I'm going to the high school. I said, good, good. He's like, I hate this place. I said, you know, Spencer, I want you to say, because he said like 2 or 3 negative comments in a row. I said, I want you to say something positive now. Say, just find something. What do you have to look forward to? And he started, you know, they all cajole me because I'm like this. And I say, you got to find the positive, man. You got to marinate your mind in good stuff.
Yeah.
I said, everything in life is mindset and having good thoughts. I said, so now find the one thing. I want you to find a positive about today, even though the day is new. It's the beginning of the day. And he goes, my sister's going to meet me at the high school and show me around. I said, dude, beautiful. Perfect. Go with that, dude.
That's great.
I said, because everything's got a positive to it.
It does.
You just got to find it.
It does.
You get a, you know, a letter in the mail from the IRS. Maybe you'll make friends with somebody. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe the agent will be cool. I don't know. Hey.
When I get those letters, I just go, I got more gigs. Yay.
Yeah. We have decided to change your tax return from 2020, and you owe money now because we've decided arbitrarily to change things. And now we're letting you know, and now we want to get paid. So with that being said, I'm going to say, let's see where we are here. There we go. Mr. Brother Paul Brown. I keep it going. I always call people go Mr., but your official title is Brother. I'm going to call you Brother.
Thank you.
I don't know if you have any problems. You have any things that you kind of deal with that you kind of sort through in your business of everyday musicianship?
Yeah. You know, by the way, that sounds like something Rich would play. That's crazy awesome music, man.
That was actually sung by some friends of mine. I had him do some gang vocals.
And no way!
I produced it up with the some sort of game show music that apparently is what I'm using.
That's awesome.
But it's a karaoke track, and I think I'm licensed for it, maybe. But I use it for 10 seconds sparingly.
Yeah. Great. Well, then as long as you do it under the 10 second.
I think that's the
10 second rule.
I think that's the rule, right? I'm
going with that.
Yeah, we'll just put it there.
I think as a business owner, I think the thing that I see the most that that I find challenging is just the streaming world,
right?
And this is as clients are coming in to my studio to make records, you know, the dynamics of what's going to happen when we master it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an issue, you know,
right.
and I feel like, you know, the days where, you know, thankfully vinyl's coming back in. See, that's my positive.
Right.
Vinyl's coming back in and it's doing great.
Vinyl is making a cut. Like younger generations are starting to get back into the vinyl sound.
Yeah, man. Really? Yeah. And they're spending a lot more quality time making the vinyl records. Like now, you know, remember how you used to have those limited edition Beatles where the actual vinyl record had the picture of the Beatles on it?
Yeah.
And they're doing that all over again. They're these beautiful lacquers.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I bought one just recently called Falloween by this artist and Don Henry, who's an amazing artist and writer. But it's an orange album, and it's great. And it's like only 400 made. And right. I'm so grateful that vinyl is coming back in. But just the whole – that so many things are so accessible, so easy.
Yeah.
Before you had one single that came out on the radio, and you had to buy the record to find out what the rest was going to sound like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And now, you know, and I'm guilty of it too. You know, yeah. I just go on Spotify to hear the whole thing to see if I had something I want to even invest in, you know?
But I mean, as an artist, you can elect to have your music on those platforms, right? I mean, generally?
Well,
I mean, if you own the publishing and all that stuff.
Yeah, you definitely, basically it comes down to you and your publicist and what you want to accomplish. You know, do you want to accomplish more PR and make less money?
Right.
Or eventually make more money in the long run, or do you want to, you know, do it old school and then work a lot harder, you know, for the possibility of making more money.
Right. Right.
And thankfully that, you know, things like merch at tours are still doing great.
Yeah. And those are the tours and the money makers are the merch, right?
That's right.
Because every time you go to a show, it's like $60 for a t-shirt.
Exactly. Right. Right. $40 for an album.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when I just got back from Spain a couple of weeks ago, and while I was over there, the lead singer for the Waterboys, Mike Scott, gave me this new edition deluxe vinyl of the last Waterboys album we recorded together. And it was so great because it actually had like, it looks like a little 78 RPM album within the sleeve. So it had the big album and this small, I think it plays on 45 or something.
Oh, really?
45 speed. Yeah. And it's great. And it's in, And so those are so still viable again, you know, and
it's the waves and CD. I mean, CDs were pretty good at replicating good recordings. You know, everything kind of got degraded on the cassette generations, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything went out the window, and I guess that was preceded by the 8-track. But if you wanted to listen to your music in your car, you weren't bringing vinyl with you.
No, man. And I love 8-tracks. I love how they clicked in between.
Yeah,
in between, right in the middle of the song, they clicked to go to the next track and play the finish.
Well, even like, you know, you remember when the CD Walkmans came out? You had to buy the anti-skipping technology.
Oh my God! Yeah,
because your CD would skip, right?
Yes, right.
But I mean, that was about as close as it got to genuine, authentic audio realism.
I think
was
so,
moving to CD.
Yeah.
And then it's funny because in the radio business, we started experiencing satellite radio with XM and Sirius at the time, and I would listen to their signals. And when I sold cars, they'd be like, oh my gosh, you get XM. And XM is, the quality is so much better than terrestrial. And I'm listening. No, it's not. I said, this is compressed audio. And you can hear it.
Yeah.
I mean, to the untrained ear.
Way compressed, yeah.
And I'm going, terrestrial radio's got this, they're beating the crap out of them for sound wise.
I had no idea.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing when you listen to satellite radio how just digitized it sounds. It's really, I don't know why.
Yeah,
but I mean, I guess you just get better.
So, what has less compression in radio world now?
I mean, the satellite feeds always on satellite radio always sounded compressed and digitized.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, like it was a very poor quality MP3 is what you were hearing, right?
Yes.
You know, in radio, because even in early 60s, 70s radio, when they did actually play records, you know, you were getting the authentic, stereo, or well, I guess, you know, depending on what you were listening to, AM or FM, but the fidelity was true. Yeah.
And their compression was different.
Right.
I mean, they were using tube compressors back then for the radio. That has made a huge difference.
You stick to analog mostly these days? You like the, or anything digital? You're open to all things?
I'm open to all things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I record digital.
Right.
I record on a digital platform.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm open to all. I love going into studio where they have like those 2-inch tape machines and fire them up. And
I want to go back into a radio studio and record a commercial like I used to and get a grease pencil and a razor blade and go to town.
Wow.
Just to see if I can do it. If
you
I could still do it.
I found I could still splice tape.
Can you?
About 3-4 years ago. That was longer than that.
Well, 2-inch tape is a lot different than the 1/4-inch I used to use.
Yeah. But I sure could, man. I could splice them puppies, and I couldn't believe that I still knew how to like the lighter. I couldn't believe that I still knew
like
how to do
it. Riding a bike.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was just muscle memory. Like,
erase, record, and playback is what they taught us in radio. ERP. Those are the three heads on the reel-to-reel. ERP.
That's great.
Right?
ERP.
So getting into, you know, looking back on things, would you change anything? Like looking at your career now, it's so storied. You've done so many different things. Are there regrets or would you have done things differently now that you know if you had to do it all over again? Or what do you preach to the young people coming up that you would do now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I have an answer for that. Okay. One is my mindset.
Mm-hmm.
My patience for listening and my the empathy that I have for people around me, you know, the understanding and just allowing people, their energies to breathe without feeling threatened by them. Like as a kid in middle school I would have liked to go back and where I have the mindset that I have now and be able to, because the things that I feel like I could have accomplished in that school when I wet the bed, in that homeless school, the things that I could have brought together, the people that I feel like I could have brought together, the racial barriers that I feel like I could have helped break down, just knowing, and especially when you think about in the homeless school, it was very, you had the rock audiences and you had the funk audiences, and the soul audiences and you had the radio stations were like that. So on one end, you had the handful of us that were like listening to Kiss and Aerosmith and Foreigner and Supertramp. And then on the other end, you had, they were listening to Luther Vandross and Parliament Funkadelic and I would have loved to have the mindset that I have now that I could have incorporated that into that kind of music and I could have brought so many people together because they had some great players, some great soul player, black soul players school, in that homeless school.
Yeah.
And I never got a chance to play with them
because
my mindset was all jacked up from, just that the division of it all.
Well, there's a post-traumatic stress disorder kind of thing going on. I mean, there's a lot of bullying, I would imagine.
That's right.
Just across, not just with you, but with other kids.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah. And I think that I would have loved to start back there.
Yeah.
And move from there. And then going back to my family, my mom was hooked on Demerol and she OD'd on it, which is why they separated us all, And I would so love to and wish that I could that I could go back with the person that I am now and bring our family together, and change it. But
I mean, these are the things that made you the man you are today.
That's right. They sure did. Yeah. And again, with each setback, it made me think about things a different way. And it made me just going to the positive things. And so, yeah, that's what I would have changed.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the things that every time I've had an encounter with you, first being on Rich's show, just an unbelievable, just a, relentless tide of, energy and positivity coming off of you. And you even see that in your performing. You just have just a ton of energy when you play.
I can't help it. That's why I have.
That's why you lost your finger. How? We never got around to that story.
Well, it's actually, I'm playing with the guy that I lost my finger with this Sunday.
Really?
Yeah, Mike Ferris. I love Mike Ferris, man. Dang, man. You know, it's funny. You can't, the cameras can't see this, but I'm looking through your door and it looks like light bright.
If you're out here and you come to the J2HQ, you're going to find any myriad of sound equipment and lighting that changes colors at any given
it's
time.
It's awesome. It looks like a light bright. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Great, man.
Oh, with the frosted glass over there. Yeah. My wife did that. She actually frosted that glass for me.
You're kidding. Yeah. That's brilliant.
She's very creative.
Wow, yeah. Man.
She likes to crochet or crotchet, whatever we call it.
Crotchet.
So losing the finger, did that happen?
So the Reader's Digest version is I had just ordered these new road cases for a tour that was upcoming Waterboys tour. And they were big, and I had one for my Hammond B3, and I had one for my Leslie, and they were big purple ones. Anyway, I had never unloaded or loaded these things out of my van before. Mm-hmm. I just got them. So I picked them up. The Leslie was in the road case. I drove to Franklin, the Franklin Theater, and nobody, or at least I couldn't find anybody. I pulled up there, and so I was going to unload it myself.
You're going to Hulk it in there yourself.
I was going to Hulk it in myself. That's right. It had wheels on it. If I just get it out of my van, I'm good. But what happened is it slipped, and it caught my ring finger between the wheel and the little clip on the back of my van that lock latch.
Mm.
And it just chopped it off right there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, like a good quarter of it. And it's just laying there on the ground. And so I'm freaking out. Blood is just going everywhere.
Yeah.
And I called Mike, and I ran in, and they were rushing me to the emergency room, you know, and they had this bag on it. And so I called Mike Ferris called me, and he said, "Hey, man, I'm on the way. I heard what happened. I just want you to know, you don't worry about the gig tonight, man. You're going to get paid. I got a sub coming in for you." And I'm like, no,
I'm doing
the gig. Right. So I get to the emergency room, man, and I said, "Hey, Mike, if you can just look around my van and see if you can find the rest of my finger laying on the gravel, and could you bring it up?
Because I'm going to
see
a favor."
Sew it back on. So of course he did. They brought my finger back, the rest of it, and but as it turns out, the doc said, "Man, you know, that finger ain't never going back on there." So anyway, what he did is he shot me up with some nerve blocker, and wrapped it in a big whole bandage and sent me back. And when I got back to the Franklin Theater, it was they had all my stuff set up. I had lava lamps. So I did I'm doing the gig, man, and I'm still the same me. You know, I'm just going nuts, man. You know, tons of energy. And all of a sudden, the bandages start coming off.
Nice.
And blood is going everywhere, all over my keys and the floor. Excuse me. And Mike Ferris is looking at me. He noticed what's going on, and he's looking at me. And he's you can see the shot. Somebody snapped a shot of Mike looking at me when this was happening, and you could see the look in his face, like, "Oh my God!" So,
and you're like, "What?"
Yeah. So Mike takes his camera, his phone out. He's going to take a picture, and the guys on the side of the stage. The crew sees all this blood, so they're coming out with these rags to try to wipe the blood off. And Mike goes, "No, don't touch this. This is the most rock and roll thing ever." And so, but what they did do is the security guard saw that the bandage was coming off in blood. So what he did is he went and got a latex glove, right? And so I'm playing with, this is my left hand where the finger's gone. So I'm playing with my right hand, just going nuts. And the security guard, I pull my hand back, and so while I'm playing, the security guard puts this latex glove on and duct tapes it to my hand. So all the blood, you know, so by the time I finished the show, it was just like this big puff.
Big bag of blood.
Yeah. And then by that time, the nerve blocker started wearing off.
And then the pain
was so brutal. And but I went back. He gave me a couple more shots. Sewed it up. Good. Mm-hmm. That's how I lost my finger. The good news is that I have most of the feeling back. It's kind of like when your foot or your hand goes to sleep and it's just coming back, that kind of tingling thing that happens. That's where it's at.
It's never, perpetual state of that.
Never changes. Yeah.
But, oh my gosh. So what was the positive in that scenario that you were like,
I played the gig.
There you go.
I did the gig.
I could still do it.
And it made a huge thing. I mean, gosh, I could have so easily bailed out from it.
Right. Right.
But I did it. I did the gig.
And it says a lot about your character. You weren't going to bail out. And even, you know, you're playing with him again.
Yeah.
Here on this weekend.
Oh, man. We're joined at the hip. Mike Ferris and I, man. We are like, he's like the brother I never had. Man, I love that cat to death, man.
Your story reminds me, you're familiar with Huey Lewis, right?
Yeah.
And what he's gone through?
Not what he's gone through.
Meniere's disease.
What is that?
He lost his hearing.
No.
For the majority of the time he was in that band, he could only hear through one ear.
Can
you believe that? So he says, and all of a sudden I was going on stage. It was maybe a couple of years ago. I think it was 2019 or 2020. And there's actually, I want to say on Netflix or Amazon, an addendum to the original Behind the Music that they did probably 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Right. So they amend it now. They actually have brought them back. They did one with Bret Michaels. They got one with Huey Lewis in the News, the Backstreet Boys. So Huey Lewis in the News was, I guess he's been losing his hearing throughout his entire career through one ear. And then one time he says, we're about to walk on stage. I'm walking back behind all the stuff and I'm listening to the opening act and I'm going, what is that noise? It sounds like it's just like, static and crackling. And they're like, oh, that's the closing band. What's wrong with the sound system? Nothing. He goes, oh, I can't hear them. It just sounded like in his ears. And he's like, to his band, he's like, guys, I'm not sure if I could find pitch because I can't hear anything. He says, so literally I was up there just doing the best I could, get the show done and try and figure this out afterwards. And all I could hear was just in my ears. It sounded like somebody just with, two giant plastic bags.
Wow.
Or paper bags, crumpling them. Can you imagine that?
No. And
gosh.
And so there's a new version of the documentary Behind This Music.
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah.
And he
talks very frankly about it. I mean, Rich and I interviewed him on Rich's podcast, and he was very frank about it, very upfront, didn't really try to hide behind it. It is what it is.
So when you guys did, at the time you guys interviewed him, where was his hearing at then?
It was past that point. I mean, I think he could hear, conversational level stuff, mm-hmm. but as far as getting up on a stage, which is that's his thing. He loves, the whole band loves to play live.
Yeah.
They can't do it anymore.
Dang, in that voice.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. And it's funny that he thought he never was a good singer.
Oh, my God.
Right? Such an iconic voice.
Yes. No one like him.
Dude, I would love to be in, a horn band. I always tell, what kind of band would you want to be in? I'm like, I would love to be in a Huey Lewis in the News tribute band. But let's throw some AC/DC in there. Let's throw some hair metal. And it's like, I don't know what I want to do. Maybe I need to start a bunch of different bands. But I mean, just playing Huey Lewis and all the horn stuff. Maybe yacht rock, right? Yacht rock is starting to be huge again. All the Christopher Cross stuff, all the Chicago with the horn set. Oh, dude. Yeah. I love that stuff.
Well, see, the thing about that is that when you get a band like that, when you and you do there's the songs with horns in it, they're great. But then when you do the rock songs where there's no horns, they're like
bunch of guys just hanging around.
Man.
Yeah. But you do the best you can with it.
Yeah. But what would be awesome is if you could do a rock song, like a Kiss song, and add horns in it.
You could.
Then you're good. And I think that would be a blast.
There's a kid on TikTok. I can't remember his name, but he'll take music and songs that don't have saxophone in it, and he puts saxophone in it. And he's an amazing player.
Oh, wow.
So he'll go, he's like, I don't know, he's from some European country, I don't know, I think. But he'll go to some place like the boiler room in his apartment complex, and he'll, you know, play the song. He'll have it in his in-ears. He'll record the sax track and then combine them all and make the video and stuff. It's amazing.
Wow.
It is amazing. It's like songs you'd never anticipate with a sax track. All of a sudden, well, that makes sense. It just makes sense. Like Since You Were Gone, by Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah.
Right? He puts it to that, and it's just during the solo parts.
You have to send me that. You have to send me that.
It's amazing. Utterly amazing.
Imagine Detroit Rock City with a killer horn section. Yeah.
You could totally pull it off.
You could totally pull that off.
If an orchestra could play with Metallica, you could pull that off.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Where do people find and follow you? Because you do have a lot of loyal fans and followers, and I think that, you know, they love you as much as you love them, and they follow, I think, because of your energy and your positivity. But where, for somebody new listening,
Can they? First of all, Brother Paul on YouTube.
Right.
Just Brother Paul Brown on YouTube. I have a channel, and I'm constantly updating.
Are you?
Yeah. I have Brother Paul Patreon page, where I'm doing live cast and I'm doing all kinds of stuff that's kind of off the grid that subscribers can dial into and be a part of.
Right.
And then, of course, Facebook, Brother Paul Brown, and then Twitter, Brother Paul Brown, Instagram, Brother Just Paul Brown.
I'm Brother all Paul the, Brown there.
Yeah. But the YouTube channel is really cool, man, because I'm always updating. I'm always putting new stuff just as I'm doing them, you know. Yeah. Like, I one of the bands, the singers that I play with was Jimmy Jameson for Survivor.
Yeah,
Tiger. Yeah. So
God rest his soul.
Yeah, man. Oh, my
God. What a voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So at the Hard Rock a couple months ago, they did this bronze statue of him, Celebration of Life. And they did it at the Hard Rock Cafe on Beale Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted me to be a part of this, right? All of a sudden, I found this intro that I did for Jimmy and the Survivor from like 2000.
Really?
1999 and 2000 was the 2 years that I played with him. And so I took that in and I did a video collage to that intro.
Nice.
And so I put it up on YouTube. But to unveil the statue, they used that intro. And it was epic, man.
Nice.
Hearing it through because they had a beautiful sound system, and getting to play with all my buddies again, Jim Petrick and all the, man, it was so amazing to see all these people again, you know, I hadn't played those songs since 2000.
Yeah.
So getting to play, you know, Rock Hard, man. And, you know, it was so much fun to get in playing with the guys that were I was playing with back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Now, do you think Survivor made Rocky, or did Rocky make Survivor?
Oh, man, I think it was...
what a great song. Iconic. The song with the loudest tambourine in history.
Yeah.
Eye of the Tiger.
One of my favorite things that associate with that is the night at the museum where Ben Stiller is his first night in there. He's like, yeah, he's Eye of the Tiger! And it conks out. Oh, man, it's hilarious. But yeah, I think... yeah, I think definitely.
They complimented each other for sure.
Definitely, yeah.
You saw Eye of the Tiger back in the 80s, and you thought about getting hit in the face by Mr. T.
Yeah.
So that was the imaging.
That's right. Oh, my
gosh, man. Seeing that movie in 1982, 83 as a 7-8-year-old, man, he was just – I would love to interview Mr. T because he's such a, like – ardent Christian believer now.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I mean, quotes Bible scripture on Twitter and everything. And I would love to interview him and be like, dude, you were the most intimidating SOB in my life. Like, you know, that movie had such like almost nightmarish effects on me. You know? And it's just even watching it now, it's like, you know, it gives you the chills. You know, just the way they filmed it and how he just, you know, would run and the sound effects.
Clubber Lang.
Clubber Lang. And, you know, and poor Rocky just getting his ass beat, you know.
Oh, man.
And then, you know, but and then Apollo Creed and he, you know, team up and everything. But, yeah. But man, so there you go. Find everything you can down in the description. Of course, follow along with whatsyourproblempodcast.com where you can find all the pertinent links there. Hey, if you know somebody who wants a podcast, check out itsyourshow.co. Of course, we'll put that in the description as well. And Mr. Brother Paul, yeah, thank you for coming out today.
Thank you, Jim.